The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hey everyone, I'm Sarah Edmondson.
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, aka Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are just a little bit culty. We were in a cult and we woke up, and it was all captured in a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, also in my memoir, Scarred.
And then we made this podcast. I guess you could say we're technically a cult show now.
But not your typical cult show. We're not so much about the grisly details. We are about kicking the doors down on the shame and the secrets that make these culty things so destructive.
We're here to have frank conversations about how cool things can cross over into the cultiverse. How to spot trouble when you see it, and what happens when it comes to recovering from something culty, if that happens to you.
Each week, we'll call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
We're here to share what we know on everything from red flags to resiliency, and to have a few laughs along the way, because sometimes you gotta laugh.
Thank God. Now, we have a lot to cover, so let's get this show rolling, shall we? A Little Bit Culty Season 2 drops new episodes every Monday on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or at alittlebitculty.com. Welcome back, everybody.
Good morning, afternoon, wherever you may be.
Evening, middle of the night. We have a very long but fabulous episode, so we're going to get right to it. Here's the deal. In 2009, Laura Tucker attended the Sedona Spiritual Retreat and, quote unquote, sweat lodge that resulted in the deaths of fellow attendees, Liz Newman, Kirby Brown, and James Shore. Today, Laura is the host of the Free Your Inner Guru podcast, a photographer, writer, and a self-described recovering coach.
You may recognize her from Enlighten Us, a CNN film Netflix documentary about the self-help industry and the Wondery podcast, Guru, The Dark Side of Enlightenment. She has also appeared on CNN Newsroom with Brooke Baldwin and William Shatner's The Unexplained. She most recently made headlines when she published this pointed essay on her blog, 9 Perfect Strangers Made Me a Punchline, and Now I'm Punching Back.
We have so much to ask her. Here's our talk with A Little Bit Culty about her experience and what it means to stand up for survivors of bad gurus. Welcome, Laura Tucker. Good morning.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We are very excited and have a bazillion questions on an amazing whiteboard that I'm looking at right now. And I don't even...
In my handwriting.
Is that why it's amazing?
Yeah. I write with really neat print.
Nippy has actually way better handwriting than I do. We're here to talk to Laura Tucker, who, by the way, I'm so glad that we met in person when you were out in Vancouver.
Yeah, that was just amazing. It was a great chance to walk and talk and discover some of our common ground.
Which yes. We have a
surprising,
lot of,
but not surprising.
Well, what was the most surprising to me is that I didn't know about this guy and this group and this story that we're going to talk about today. And I think it's because it happened mostly like, you know, when it was in the news, it was in 2009, when Nippy and I were knee deep in Nexium, we didn't really listen to or watch the news. So I think I may have missed it because of that. What do you think, Nip? Do you think we just were like, we were in curriculum and too busy to like turn on CNN? The point being that I didn't know about it. So when you told me, I was like, what? So you know, it was fresh ears for me. And the more we've done a deep dive to prepare for this episode, the more, you know, more questions we have and, you know, parallels we drew. But for the audience to be able to do the deep dive with us, we'd love to just get sort of the cliff notes of, as you know, with our podcast, how did you get in? How did you wake up? How are you healing? But will you tell us a little bit about where you were when a friend gave you the secret in the mid-2000s? What was the early 2000s?
I got to put it about at 2007 because okay. I had just turned 40. There was some debate last year about what year that was, but I've since gone back and realized that it was in and around the time that I had just turned 40. And a friend of mine had seen that I was having some difficulty. And just for context, I was living in Kelowna, British Columbia, which is not too far away from you guys right now.
That's right.
And I had moved from Toronto. So I had uprooted, and this was all very much what I wanted. I wanted to be in the mountains. I wanted to be where I could do photography alongside my consulting business. And in those years, 2007, 2008, and 2009, the Great Recession hit. So my one really stable, reliable part of my life was my consulting business. And I think a lot of people will relate to this right now. Mm-hmm. It was much slower onset than with all the change that's come with the pandemic. But I was in an unstable situation, meaning that at any moment I was working in the car industry and they were really having a hard time. And at any moment I could have lost, like if I lost one client, that would be out of, you know, maybe a maximum of four or five at any time. So it was very, very stressful. And at the same time, I was hitting another milestone birthday, and I was single, I was childless, and there was a lot of pressure because at that time I still thought that I wanted to have a child and get married, both of which things I did, although I didn't ever have my own child. I have a wonderful stepson. But back then it was a big deal. And when I was younger, I had been in and out of probably what you would call it functional depression. It never really interfered with my ability to earn a living or, you know, set goals and achieve them. But I could feel myself going down that way. And I wanted something different than going back on antidepressants, which is not any judgment on antidepressants. I just wanted to try something different because I'd gone that route before. And so when my friend Mandy handed me The Secret, I took it home for the weekend in the middle of, I even think it was around like Valentine's Day. So, you know, just kind of one of those times. Watched it over the weekend. At first, I thought it was hokey. But by the time I got through to the end, it spoke enough to me that the main message that I got from it at the time was that you have more control over your life than you might be thinking at any given moment, especially moments where you're facing challenges. And while it's easy to be critical of The Secret now, I didn't really have what you would call a spiritual life at that point in time. I'd been raised Roman Catholic and became very disenchanted and disenfranchised from being a practicing Catholic. And so along came The Secret and then ultimately James Arthur Ray, whose workshops I did over almost 18-month period.
And he was one of the main speakers, right?
He was one of the featured speakers. There's a whole gaggle of them, really, that were that first, you know, Oprah-launched spiritual teacher, law of attraction, you know, experts.
Was he the one that jumped out at you?
At the time, there were two or three that jumped out, Nippy. It's a great question. And I had explored two other of those teachers. And for one reason or another, it either didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so I became very interested in traveling to James's workshops. And if I had an opportunity to travel, especially to the Southwestern United States, where I could bring my camera, my bags of camera gear, and turn it into a half workshop, half photography trip, that was very attractive to me as far as, you know, business travel. So improve myself, go take some pictures. And that was my thing in those years.
I totally get it. I was actually telling Nippy that when The Secret came out, I wasn't that into it because I'd already seen What the Bleep, which has a similar kind of thing in terms of creating your own life and having more control than you think and manifesting your world based on your thoughts and more from a quantum physics, pseudoscience, whatever way. But like, by the time Secret came out, and I think that if I hadn't seen What the Bleep, I would have gone almost down your exact same path. Potentially we would have met at one of these workshops because I see the draw.
Well, and vice versa, because I saw What the Bleep long after I saw The Secret. And, you know, it was slightly different genre, but the same message. So I think in that world, very much like the self-help world today, it's like whatever attracts you in, it can dictate the path that you go.
Mm. Right. So the path that you went, so you started going to these workshops. What was your first impression of James Arthur Ray when he started speaking? What was your first workshop like?
Well, I first saw James Arthur Ray at his initial workshop. Was a weekend event. I flew to Oakland, which was great because I really wanted to get back to San Francisco and photograph some things I'd seen before I had good cameras. So I arrived, I was there on my own. I didn't know anyone. It was very uncomfortable for me. I was fine with traveling on my own, but traveling on my own and entering an environment with a whole, like, whole ton of people. That event probably had 400 or 500 people in it.
Wow.
So my first exposure was him on the stage. And I hadn't remembered this part comparison that I made in my mind at the time until recently, because I'm doing some writing on all of this. And his stage presence and the performative aspect of what he was doing, the speaking, the command of the stage, the personality was very, it's very high energy. He was very masterful in that environment. And not too long before that, just a couple of years or a few years before, when I was still living in Toronto, I had gone to a concert and seen Sting and Annie Lennox live. Mm-hmm. They performed together and was completely enthralled by, at the time, these 50-something-year-old people who could just radiate such, you know, energy and vitality. And at the time, I was feeling pretty beat up. So that aspect of it really captivated me. And it's interesting to look back on it because it's like, literally, you've got this idea at the time of this rock star of transformation, because that was always the goal. And that is how they used to, I don't know, because I don't look too often now, but would be described as rock stars of mm-hmm. transformation. And in my mind, I was literally comparing him to a couple of rock stars.
Mm-hmm. So what was the moment that, because we always look at this, you know, in our podcast, what's the hook? Like, we're obviously The Secret got you there, but was there a particular moment when you were there where you're like, I'm in, this is my guy, I'm going to follow him, or a shift that you had, or an awareness or something?
That's such a good question. I don't know if it was any single moment for me. And I want to say that I never looked at him like, even though I just brought out that comparison mm-hmm. to the rock star, for me, it was more about the environment and the opportunity within the environment. So it was the whole package. It was mm-hmm. the people who I were meeting, the relationships that I made, the fact that there was a certain amount of safety for me in terms of being more transparent, less guarded in that environment. So I found myself relating to people differently. And I was very into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed up for another workshop at the first workshop. But then I took what I'd learned and I went back and I applied it in my consulting business and in my life, and was actually, you know, it was quite a transformation. People who knew me at the time will remember. And so it was like the whole package was attractive to me. And then once I started going to the more advanced events, I was all in at that point.
And had Oprah endorsed him at this point?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was part of my research. There were really two things prior to signing up for that first workshop, because I never saw him do his, you know, the free two-hour intro
mm-hmm.
that ironically I would end up starting to do for him, you know, within a year or so.
We are the same person.
But we are the same person, Sarah. But I came in over the internet. I was like probably one of the first internet leads ever. I was that determined to be there. Oh yes, Oprah. So looking around the internet at things, I had the Oprah endorsement to, you know, that validated some form of credibility. And then there was a huge article in Fortune magazine that was very, very flattering. And I read it. And these were things that absolutely contributed mm-hmm. to me, you know, going down that path without a doubt.
Okay. Do you think you would have done it had those endorsements not been there?
I think it was a lot less likely.
Right. Yeah. Because one of the things in the story that struck me is, you know, Oprah and these people endorse these people and these things happen. And I'm not saying Oprah's responsible by any means. There's certainly a participation from these magazines and these media outlets that promote certain people like this. And when tragedy happens, you don't really hear much from them. And I'm sure you're not the only person who read a Fortune magazine or saw it on Oprah and must have stopped your inquiry, as maybe you would have done more questions had those endorsements not been there. I don't know. You can never say in hindsight's 20/20, but to me, that's always that stood out in listening and doing the research on this whole thing. Is like, that's pretty.
Like, did anyone look at his credentials?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, and you'll understand this now
for sure.
Host of your show, right? Like, before I do a podcast, and especially because of my experience, I make sure that I read every single, if someone's promoting a book, I read it cover to cover. And my podcast is mostly by invitation at this point, because I get so much solicitation and could never keep up on it all. And I feel a certain amount of responsibility to my audience and to the content. And I would never dream of having someone on who, well, there's no guarantees that I hadn't thoroughly vetted in advance. You know, I'll speak to Oprah ever so briefly to say that not once, because there's really nothing to say other than not once since October the 8th, 2009, has she spoken about it in any way, shape, or form.
How do you feel about that?
We're really going to go there?
I mean, you know, we can take it out. You don't have to edit it. I mean, that might chat my ass a little bit.
That was on my list.
Yes.
But before we do, I think we're going from the assumption that we know what happens. Our audience doesn't know.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's just circle back to that Oprah's lack of response to her endorsing this guy, and then what happened, our audience doesn't know yet. So, I mean, a lot of things happened, but and really, you know, when you told me this, what happened to you, I was really shocked, but I didn't really put it all together until I did also, like you said, did the research, watched the documentaries, listened to the Wondery podcast. And it's really upsetting. What happened to you and your friends is terrible and was a huge tragedy and should never have happened. And the fact that this guy did what I'm going to ask you to sort of walk us through it is like, this is, you know, we laugh in this podcast and there's obviously lots of things to laugh about, but death occurred in your situation. And I want to just be clear that you know, the tragedy that occurred in your, this is a serious part, I guess, is what I'm trying to articulate.
You know, Sarah, thank you very much for bringing that into the room, because it is such a big thing that happened. Mm-hmm. You know, chances are, because it happened before the internet really became what it is, you know, it was early Facebook days, and, you know, there's lots out there online, but it is surprising how few people know about it. But it's not surprising because nothing really changed after the fact. There was no moment of enlightenment in the self-help industry. It's a long arc as far as any positive outcome coming from it. Mm-hmm. So I'll walk the listeners through, and I'll give a bit of a caveat before I do that. If you want to hear more detail, not that I'm out, you know, flogging this podcast, but there is a great amount of detail to the tune of 8 episodes in this true crime podcast called Guru, The Dark Side of Enlightenment. And there's a feature-length documentary film called Enlighten Us that came out in 2016.
Both are fantastic, by the way. We will have those in our show notes.
For sure.
Do encourage people to listen and watch both, because they're much more in depth than what we're going to do today. Unfortunately, we only have an hour with you, and our focus, I really would like to be at your opinions about the self-help industry and what's happened since then and the lack of accountability. Because truthfully, when I heard this, I was like, oh, this happened so long ago, and we were focusing more on current groups. But it is current, because this guy is still practicing. He's still out there being a guru, right? The problem still exists, separate from James Arthur Ray.
Exactly. Right? And if anything, that industry is still thriving since this.
With no accountability.
Yes. With no accountability, with no restrictions. So anyway.
Yes, please do walk us through, knowing that people can get all of the details on these other platforms.
So the way that James Ray's workshops were structured was, you know, there was the initial workshop and then a series of other workshops that were, so the initial 2-day and then these 5-day workshops. And the way that it was always presented was that the pinnacle event was called Spiritual Warrior, and it took place in Sedona. And the way that my timeline laid out was exactly in the order of the workshops. You know, I did them in, and because there was flexibility in the middle. But as it turned out, I did them all in order. And my last workshop of the series was going to be Spiritual Warrior. So Spiritual Warrior was unlike the other workshops in a number of ways, including the horrific outcome. But it was out in the hills about 40 minutes west of Sedona, which becomes relevant when we start to talk about getting emergency services there. Mm. And at the end of this 5 days, which was more or less, it was a very individual retreat. It wasn't, there was no stage. There was only about 50 people there. It was 5 days of introspection, small size workshops, but like all of the other events, very long days and long nights. We didn't have our own hotel rooms. We were sharing either cabins or these oversized teepees with others. And I was actually thinking about that very recently. And that gave even more impetus to, for me anyways, because I wasn't sleeping all that well, to stay up all night doing my journaling and doing my writing. And it was very, very intense. In the last, say, 48 hours, there were back-to-back events that were challenges, and the culminated, we were out in the desert on what he called a vision quest. And then we went from there back into the classroom for a debrief and then went and did a ritual. And I want to preface all of this by highlighting that both vision quests and sweat lodges are indigenous closed rituals. Of course, I didn't know this at the time, but it's very important in the retelling of this story today. And so a sweat lodge is a ceremony where you go into an enclosed structure that is low to the ground. It's like a low dome. And in the middle of the sweat lodge, there is a hole in the ground. And it's a pretty sizable hole, maybe 3 feet in diameter. And outside the lodge, there's a fire where stones are heated. Large stones are heated on the fire. And in, you know, this routine or ceremony, they're brought in to the middle of the lodge and their heat emanates throughout the structure and to the people who are in it. And so the intention of the sweat lodge was, it was first of all, the culminating challenge of all the challenges. And it was the idea that it was a symbolic of rebirth and transformation, and it was last. And the whole idea was that we would have the lodge go get cleaned up and then celebrate the end of a week of a lot of rigorous inner work. And instead of that, everything that could go wrong did go wrong in the sweat lodge. And things just got out of hand. It's really hard to break down into sort of small pieces, but we were sitting inside in concentric circles around, in two rows around the pit. And I was initially next to a woman whose name is Liz Newman. She wasn't a participant in the workshop. She was on the dream team. So she had a slightly different role than me as a participant. So she was sitting right next to me, which was very comforting. And she had provided me and two of my friends a little bit of guidance about, you know, if it gets really hot in the lodge and it's extremely uncomfortable, here's what to do. And James had outlined before going in, you know, what our expectations, you know, some of the expectations, which I can come back to in a moment if you want. But throughout the sweat lodge, you know, the heat was indescribable. When the stones, which were called grandfathers, were brought into the pit and some water was doused on them, the steam would roll up. You're seated with your back to the exterior, your knees up. It would just roll over your body in these cascading waves that were, you know, scorching. And the way it's organized is that there are rounds, and we ended up doing 8 rounds in the lodge. And somewhere in the middle, I became very, very concerned about Liz Newman. She had moved from sitting beside me to sitting in front of me because there was an opening there. She was leaning back on my shins, and things didn't seem right. She wasn't behaving how she had guided us to behave. And it was very disconcerting. We had arranged with each other to tap so that we would, you know that we were okay. And the patterns of tapping changed it. So I spoke up in the middle of the lodge, which, you know, you weren't to speak unless spoken to. You know, James was just listened to Guru the other day on the anniversary. And, you know, he was very clear that, you know, you don't speak unless you're spoken to, that it's hot. And listening back to it, especially after this past year, was really jarring. But at the end of the day, I spoke up and expressed concern for Liz. And he initially, I don't think he heard me, but the second time I spoke up, he did. And he told me, you know, Liz has done this before, which was true. She had done it many times. I think about 7 times over the years with him. You know, she knows what she's doing. And then I asked her I reached up to her shoulder, asked her if she needed to leave, and she tapped me and tapped my hand away. So I got a nonverbal response to a verbal question. And at that point, I was like, all right, you know, I guess it's me. And I put my head back and basically powered through the rest of the sweat lodge.
When did you find out that she passed?
So Liz passed away in the hospital 8 or 9 days later. And what happened at the end was actually, I learned this from listening to the Guru podcast, because there's so many people there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was never any time, because we were broken apart. We were, you know, we had, the police came in.
Never got to put the pieces together.
Yeah, you never, really never got to. But what I did learn was that there were 4 people left in the sweat lodge, and I was number 4. So everybody else who lived got out. I was in a position where Liz was still leaned back on me, and people at the end realized, I guess, that I didn't have this knowledge, but listening to Guru, they realized there were still people in the sweat lodge, and they came running in, and she wasn't moving under her own steam. And so they took her out. And then only then was I able to gather myself up and crawl out.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the #IGotOut project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the #IGotOut movement and find resources at igotout.org. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its 3rd season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions.
And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective, and with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable! That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY.
Wow. Can you describe the scene when you came out of the sweat lodge, what you saw there?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that it was bright. You know, it was still the afternoon. I'd been in this dark, pitch dark, basically tent.
For a few hours.
For a couple of hours, yeah. At least. Yeah. And
good God.
Yeah. So there wasn't much relief from the emanating heat from my body because it was still pretty warm. It was afternoon in Sedona in October. So it's still pretty warm out. There were tarps on the ground and there was a hose running with water and people were getting hosed down because you were all wet from sweat, like just drenched. Mm-hmm. And you get out and now all the sand is sticking on you. And so the blast of the cold water of being hosed off was quite memorable. And all around me, so I came out the side of the door, the flap where we entered. And Kirby Brown and James Shore, they were around the other side of the sweat lodge. I mean, at that point, I could hardly move. I was just sat in place looking around, taking in, you know, the people were in distress. Some were quite disassociated. I was looking for my friends who had been on either side of me. And at that point, I never saw Liz again. I'm not sure. I don't have memory of where she was afterwards. And after they wanted to clear the scene, by they, I mean his staff, not the emergency vehicles and helicopters had not arrived yet. But I staggered away from the scene, got showered, and then we were all told to meet in for basically interrogation in the dining hall.
That was by the police.
Did you see him? Did you see James Arthur Ray after you got out?
Just from a distance.
Okay.
At first, sort of seated in a chair and then standing over what I would later learn to be Kirby and James Shore.
Did they die there at the scene or in the hospital also?
They died at the scene.
And just so our audience knows, 3 people died
total
from that.
Yeah. It's big, hey?
Yeah. That's pretty intense. I don't know.
Thank you for having this conversation. And I have full empathy for you hearing something like this because of the crazy similarities in circumstance that lead up to these things.
I know that you get it more than most people. And the thing that James Arthur Ray kept saying that was, I'm not going to lie, it was super triggering because it's the same thing, just different words, was that he kept saying, and this has been part of the indoctrination or the programming that led to people staying there, was he would say play full on, right?
That was the mantra.
Yeah, play full on.
Right. Yeah.
We had different words for it in our group, but you know, that's, I actually just spoke to Yanya Lalich. I called her just before this because I love her and I consult with her all the time on things like this. For those who don't remember, she was in season 1 as one of our cult experts. And I was asking her what she thought of this. You know, is it a cult? Is it something? But what were her opinions? And ultimately, one of the main things we both agreed on is that you had, and just like everyone there, you were all in what she calls a bounded choice. It's the illusion of choice. Your choice is
double bind.
Yeah, that's what we talked about in our group. But it was either do the thing and play full on, or you don't do the thing and you're admonished or made fun of or shamed, or you're not part of the team anymore. You're not part of the dream team. And just to go back a little bit, I think that he created this mess. Obviously, he's responsible, and he set it up in such a way that when you first got there, I'm just going to go back a little bit. When you first got to Spiritual Warrior, the first thing that people were asked to do was get their head shaved, right?
Right.
And that, I mean, as you know, I have an attachment to my hair. that may have been where I jumped, but also for sure I would have been pushed because, you know, I'm attached, right? Got to break that attachment. My attachment, it's my hair. It's how I know, how I feel pretty and how I know I'm loved and all that stuff.
You're ultimately in a situation where anything you say is going to be held and yeah. used against you as not playing full on or,
oh yeah.
So you're back, cornered, you're cornered.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Especially
at that point,
especially since this last year where I wanted to share with you before sitting down with you today, I actually went back and listened to your interview about, oh my gosh, not coercion, consent.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
consent.
You, Nepi.
Yeah.
And, yeah. and out of the first time I heard it, every 5 seconds, I was just like, poke, like the triggers of trauma and understanding things at a different level, the bells were going off. And, you know, in the early years, and by early years, I mean like the first decade, right? It's been 12 years. It's really only been mm-hmm. this last couple of years that I've been receptive to looking at this through the lens that it always gets categorized as. Like if you go and look at the Enlighten Us and Guru, it's in the cult category of documentaries. And I've always been so against using that label, and I still stand by my main reason.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Right?
Yep. Because yep. when you call it a cult, then it allows the rest of the industry to look at it and say, well, that's not like us. Mm-hmm. We're not a cult.
Right.
And then you get to this situation where and no one of influence will own that they're exactly like it mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. do the heavy lifting of creating a safe and legislated and industry that has professional standards and recourse for when, you know, basically abusers are in these roles of extreme responsibility.
Exactly.
I think that's the key distinction. I say it almost every podcast. The abuses of power are really what we're talking about right now. And the abuses that go on in cults aren't proprietary to cults.
No.
They're everywhere. So I can appreciate that.
That's ultimately what Yanya said. And she said she hadn't done a deep dive on this particular guru, but cult or LGAT, large group awareness training, doesn't even really matter. The fact is that there's this guy, and this is happening rampantly in the industry, where they're doing therapy without a license. And this happened same in Nexium too. Like we weren't trained professionals and we were doing a deep dive into people's psyches.
Yeah. And the one thing too is that when you're going to events like this, it's because you're looking for something better or a deeper understanding. I'd done an undergrad degree in psychology. I was already, you know, I was the perfect candidate to go into that environment mm-hmm. and then, you know, moth to the flame kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was me to a T. And the benefits that I was receiving were very, very real. However, so were all of these other dynamics that I now understand are cult dynamics, mm-hmm. right? So within the last few months, I've started to embrace the C word, as I've been calling it. Mm-hmm. And because it's something that people understand, you know, so it may not be what a traditional cult looks like, where people are off living on a compound or commune together. But I think we're also seeing that because I've looked at this a lot, and as are you, there is a broader understanding of cult, and it's needed because even what technology alone, that's just one factor, but what the internet has done for indoctrination and groups and influence and undue influence, you know, it's changed the face of it. I hate to say this because I always been a big proponent of self-help and personal growth, but you don't have to look very far in the self-help model to see dynamics that are inherently culty.
100%.
And the mm-hmm. the outcomes are dependent 100% on the moral fiber and the moment that the leader is in.
Exactly.
And that's a mm-hmm. lot of responsibility on one
person.
It's
a lot of responsibility. And that was, you know, we're obviously always right. comparing and contrasting. And it seems like James Arthur Ray isn't necessarily a sociopath like Keith is. and we didn't get to this in the story, but I'll just let our listeners know, is that as soon as he heard that people had died, he talked to a criminal lawyer who told him to leave, and he left the scene and didn't help his so-called friends who had been hurt and were going to the hospital. He just left. And to me, that was one of the most disturbing things of this whole situation, that he didn't take responsibility. And his whole shtick is about, you know, facing life's adversities full on, playing full on. And when he had the opportunity to actually do that, he hightailed it out of there. And I thought, wow, you didn't walk the walk. You're not really a guru. You are a weak, selfish, money-focused, narcissistic prick. That, to be totally honest, in my opinion.
When there was opportunity to demonstrate he was embodiment of what he was teaching, he failed at every point. And even the reconciliations afterwards were responsibility statements with caveats to them to not fully incriminate and take responsibility for what he did. And he seeked to minimize the abuse that he was responsible for rather than really take a bite out of the shit sandwich that he created. That's what I saw.
Yeah, my ass was really chapped in the documentary. He's doing this whole like, and I take responsibility. And, you know, even though there were people who were paid to do their jobs, I take responsibility. That was part one of my ass chappings. Part two, him later saying that, I heard him say somewhere that that had to happen. What happened in Sedona had to happen for him to grow as a teacher and to go to the next level. And I thought, how disgusting. Like, you know, we can go, hey, this bad thing happened in our lives and now we're making the most of it. No, that didn't have to happen though. That didn't have to happen for us and didn't have to happen for him. I just think that's so self-focused and gross.
Well, when he was also asked about the deaths, he's like, my world changed.
Yeah,
like,
your world changed? Yeah, he's like, my whole world changed in 15 minutes.
And listen, I watch these things like when everyone is banging on someone and saying horrible things, I try to keep a little bit of empathy for the subject. But there were repeated times where that guy could have
handled it so differently.
Dove in. And been like, okay, this is a guy who was trying to do good and stumbled. And I just kept getting the feeling that he had a used car salesman vibe. He was after monetary and esteem from others. And the way he thought he was doing that was helping other people. Like,
and that just fed his ego.
He really leaned into the guru thing and enjoyed that. And that was the objective more so than say, you know, helping people. And who am I to say that that's not true? But I look at him and I look at, say, Tony Robbins. And Tony Robbins, I've gone back and forth with, but I do believe that guy cares. And my question to you is let's say, what's the difference between James Ray and a Tony Robbins? And let's say Tony Robbins inadvertently has an event where someone dies. What do you think the distinctions are? And why should Tony Robbins have what he's having? And if James Ray doesn't have three deaths, the distinction, right? Like if James Ray doesn't have those three deaths on his resume right now, where would he be? And like, and do you agree? And like, what are the distinctions if you've looked at Tony Robbins or?
Well, I really don't see a distinction, to be honest.
Okay.
I can't. I don't. Mm-hmm. I've tried.
Same person, different platform.
How come?
Well, I just want to, if I may, just backtrack a little bit to like, sure. I think things could have gone very differently for James Arthur Ray had he had presence of mind and been a leader at the scene instead of vacating.
Absolutely. To me, that was shocking to see that. Like, yeah. I just don't know how
I understand being scared. I understand wanting to run away, but I don't understand actually running away.
Right.
And that is something that really, you know, I think that was a defining moment. They're big on defining moments in the self-help industry. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was a defining moment.
Choice point.
However, when you start to hear that after the fact that there were issues in previous years,
yes,
and that the Lakota Nation had asked him to stop doing sweat lodges and they have like a declaration of war on false shamans and gurus appropriating their ceremonies. You know, like at the time, I was completely discombobulated by the fact that they pressed a lawsuit on James. And you have to understand, at the time, I was still very much, identifying in almost like an us versus them way because of the way it had been dragged out in the media. And I just didn't understand it. But this was like very, very freaking serious. Mm-hmm. And that it ever got to the point that conditions would be created that three people were killed is just doesn't, even to this day, just doesn't compute.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason anybody has ever heard of the goings on is that three people's died.
Right.
Yeah.
So when I hear things behind the scenes about people being injured at other big gurus events and people speaking out about, you know, some fairly serious character flaws in the vein of, you know, hashtag me too, I think whenever any of these leaders, organizations, and businesses grow to the outsized scale of these, there's just no way. First of all, I don't think they could run it profitably if they had the proper resources in place to run it in a healthy and monitored way. You have people there volunteering their time as quote unquote coaches, you know, event facilitators, ushers. My one and only live exposure to Tony Robbins actually launched my podcast. You know, it was here in Toronto at an event, and I went and was supporting a client who was, she was on in a panel that day at this big event. The fear and scarcity based selling that I saw all day at this event that is, you know, sanctioned by, you know, the Tony Robbins himself, and then the dynamic of this elevated figure that people who just want to touch because
that's not healthy.
He's had such a great, it's not real.
No, mm-hmm.
That's not real.
Can I clarify the fear and scarcity? Do you mean in regards to selling, like there's only three spots left and that kind of thing? Yeah. The upselling, the scarcity, I mean, caveat, I did all that, right? And you probably did too when you were selling for James Ray, like that's how you were trained to do it, right? So it works, but it's disgusting and it's, yes, inauthentic.
Definitely how I was trained.
Yeah.
It's not what I did when I got on the stage. It was,
yeah.
So that was, I was of this mindset that I was going to kind of do it my own way and show that there is another way.
Mm-hmm.
It never got off the ground because things blew apart before anything of substance, you know, took place.
But you can see it now. Like when you go to those other events, like I've never seen Tony Robbins, and maybe we do another episode on him and do a deep dive. But I guess when I started watching the resources you sent us, I was like, wow, he's like a mini Tony Robbins, but he never got to that level. But it seems like that's where he was trying to get. And regardless, it's the same problem. Again, therapy without a license and guru-fying somebody who's, regardless of their intentions, we don't know what their intentions are because we're not them. But the fact is that people are getting hurt because they don't have the resources.
Their character is revealed in times of adversity. It happened in our case as well when Keith was exposed in Mexico and the police came, the federales came down and he went and hid in the closet and let the women handle protect him. And I think they don't ever think they're going to be in a situation that has to do that. And their pursuit of whatever their pursuit is, it seems material and ego driven. And they're always in a position of calling you out, but there's never in a position of being on the other end of the drill sergeant that they are administering on other people. And that was the thing that, you know, I'm allergic to when someone is always in a position of being a drill sergeant when they don't necessarily have an acumen. You know, one of the things I kept thinking about when I was watching this thing is like, you know, as a guy who played sports growing up, one of the things, at least when I was a kid, is getting water during practice was considered kind of weak or whatever. It's less so now because coaches are liable and players have fallen from heat strokes and now, but that was one of the things as a kid, and you wanted to do it right. You wanted to impress your coach. And your coach was pushing you, and that was supposedly a good thing. But at what cost? And the cost was something that wasn't in there. They're not doctors. They don't know that telling their kids and their athletes not to get water is bad for them. Similarly, you know, he seemed to be in a situation of pushing people through a sweat lodge, but not being a doctor and knowing that it's not good for them to be in a sweat lodge for 2 hours. So, and particularly with how he set it up, you know, how he set it up was if you're having a heat stroke, basically you're doing it right.
He described the symptoms of
heat stroke. That's what I heard.
Is that right?
Well, and you think about what's happening there. It's like to be clear, the reason why I'm still in this marathon of talking about it 12 years later is that, you know, A, it was a very significant event in my life and many others, but also this kind of stuff is happening now, yep. Not necessarily and literally in sweat lodges, but taking away people's agency, mm-hmm. You know, so when you're talking about like conditioning people, removing their objections ahead of time in a highly trusted environment, which is also known as a high demand or high control group, it's a lot more systematic than I ever gave it credit for in the intervening years. It's only as I'm starting to study the, you know, the true nature of cult dynamics and undue influence that I'm seeing like, wow, it scares me. During my time of going into this self-help and spiritual environment, it was the recession. Well, today it's the pandemic and all of the sudden change. And these dynamics are very much alive and not well. Mm-hmm. And not only that, there are like legions of people who have been trained or who are emulating these other leaders. And spend enough time talking with people who know what's going on. Like, this is just a very short example, but this was before the sweat lodge. But I traveled to speak in one of the cities where there was a fairly large hub of, you know, James Ray followers. And there was one person who had left the community, but she wanted to get together with me for lunch. She just wanted to meet this person who was doing these events. And we got along like gangbusters. I didn't really know her all that well up till that point. And then she dropped a comment. I asked her, you know, why aren't you involved anymore? And she said, I left because of his unethical use of NLP. Mm. And I sat there and I was like, I don't know what she's talking about. Like, what's NLP, right? Neuro-linguistic programming. Mm. And so then a conversation, this is one of the many, many red flags, but like there are things going on behind the curtain where very determined people, because they're very determined for their own goals and dreams. Like, yes. Everyone wants to own an island. Everyone wants a private jet. I'm being a bit facetious, but at the top levels of the industry, that's the life they live.
Yeah.
And they've studied persuasion. They've studied influence. They've crafted their performance, and it's a performance.
It is.
And it is acted on and emulated and trickles down. So I actually believe that there are a large number of people in the self-help and coaching industry who are using some of these tactics without knowing it, who are very well intentioned. And then there are others, but doesn't mean the tactics aren't happening. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the sales funnel and getting to that breakthrough, because you got to have a breakthrough to justify the expense, mm-hmm. right? Like it really, there's so much pressure at mm-hmm. every angle.
That was one of the similarities. People, I feel like once they've paid, I think it was 10 grand for Spiritual Warrior, like that's part of the pressure to like, okay, everyone's shaving their heads and like, I got to have a breakthrough. That might be the thing that pushes people to do what most people would be like, well, I wouldn't shave my head. I would get out of there. But really, if you pay 10 grand, you're not getting your money back. Everyone's doing it. And it's just, you want the breakthrough and you're paid for it. Like I understand how it happens.
Yeah.
You got to justify the expense.
There's a lot of justifying. There's a lot of rationalizing and there's a lot of well-intentioned, okay, well, what's the worst thing that's going to happen if I shave my head? Mm-hmm. Like really,
right?
You know, before the sweat lodge, the worst thing was that I was going to go back and you know, say, yeah, I shaved my head. You could make up any number of reasons why you did it, or it was a challenge. That part, I was a little concerned about going to my client sites and mm-hmm. going around speaking with my shaved head, and because I thought it would look like it was a cult.
Did it? Well, that is a thing. Like my agent used to be like, oh, you're going back to your cult. I'm like, yeah, Marie, mm-hmm. I'm shaving my head again. And we'd laugh. Like yeah. That's a huge cult from Synanon, which we've since learned is that's what they did in Synanon, shaved heads. But we digress. I wanted to ask you, this happened 12 years ago. What's your healing journey been like, Laura? What have you been doing to process all of this?
Well, initially, my healing was very centered on my body. And I had a huge support team of people in Kelowna who, because I was always not afraid to use up all of my benefits package that I paid for in my company. I had, you know, a chiropractor, a massage therapist, an acupuncturist.
Good.
Like I had a full team. And I can't understate how important that was for helping to move at the time a lot of that emotion and distress out of my system. And initially, I turned away from all things self-help, all things spirituality for about a period of 5 years. And this was a bit of a, this was an ongoing situation. I ended up having to testify at the trial. So this is very active in my life up until 2011. So during that time, I also started long distance running and really didn't want a whole lot to do with mind body or spirit body, but very much in my body. And then eventually I made my way back into coaching and into self-help. And I did, and I think it shows up a lot in my podcast and in, you know, speaking out on these productions, you know, even though they never really reached mass audience, the way my impression is of, say, The Vow, but they're out there as a record. And I knew, because at the time I didn't get involved in any lawsuits. And on one hand, I could look at it now and think, well, I didn't do much to protect myself, but I also didn't sign away my voice. And when the requests started coming in for these projects, I do my best to be discerning, but it's always been very important to me to, because I think it's tied to not being heard in the sweat lodge. Very much is healing to speak about it, to explore the issues. And I thought as a coach, I could have some impact in the self-help industry. That was very important to me. But within this last year, I've decided I can have more impact from the outside. So I have wrapped up my coaching and I've returned to my creative passion of photography and writing, as well as the podcast. So it's an ongoing, and you probably know this from your own experience. Like, I don't know that I'll ever reach a point where I'll just say, right, I'm healed. I'm right over it. It doesn't affect me on a day to day, because it does.
For sure.
That's what trauma does.
You know, one of the parallels I heard in your story when I was listening to it is, and I think you mentioned this, I think it was one of the interviews that you were in, you had these goals and you said you went back and you read your journals. And you said that you had these goals that you had before you got into this. I know Sarah and I can relate to that as well. And actually, before we took this thing down, Sarah and I had some conversations about, like, all we do is this. It wasn't Nexium, it was Executive Success Programs and the other companies. This is all we do. And we're helping other people achieve their goals. And we had things that we wanted to do before we got into this. And we had lost sight of that. And I find getting back to those things, and it sounds like that's what you're doing, even though there's a delay of 10 years, maybe, is the thing that's kind of going back and nurturing at least your soul, whatever you want to call it, whatever the words you want to call it, soul work, heart work, or expression, or anything like that. And that's one of the things that I related to a lot in hearing your story.
Nippy, don't you think that is a massive red flag? Like,
being, for sure.
This is how I'm looking at it now, is like being pulled off your own path.
Sarah can attest. My frustration was like, all we fucking do is this, and I want to go pursue certain things. And
you weren't allowed.
Just wasn't that allowed. We weren't playing full in, or whatever our version of what yours was, playing full in, or the double bind, the obligation that we felt hogtied in a sense by our principles, but they were their principles and not ours. And we were accelerating someone else's agenda under the guise that it was ours as well. And it didn't feel right. And, you know, we were ignoring really how we felt about things until we were face to face with someone that we had helped achieve the goal that we wanted to achieve. And I felt like someone's not helping me with that right now. I'm helping them with that. And that's fine. That's fulfilling in its own right, but not what I set out to do.
That is a really good red flag. What are the others, Laura, that you would share with people now that you've had this experience?
I don't know if I have them on demand. I just released a podcast that had a ton in them.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Okay. I'll send you the link. I was playing the role of guest on my own podcast, and we were going through a recounting of, and this was one of the big ones. And this is what I've been grappling with for the whole year. And that actually sparks one for me. I think there's really a fine line when you get into these circles. There's all this talk about raising consciousness and making a difference and healing the planet. Like, this is some of the rhetoric. And the way that I've seen that rhetoric be used this past year, and how divisive mm-hmm. that's been in society, and how so many people have embraced conspiracy thinking mm-hmm. under the guise of wellness and raising consciousness, it is terrifying and abhorrent to me. And it feels like this idea that actually was true has been co-opted to fit whatever agenda the leader of influence and spreader of doctrine is doing. So it all boils down to, we never really know. We're trusting people, we place our trust, and you never know what's going on behind the scenes. And that's why really getting vocal about what the red flags are, what the patterns are, and what the signs are, because I have so much hindsight now. And as much as we all learn and on our own experience, which is another part of the rhetoric, right? We're all, you leave them in their own experience and don't interfere. But I'd much prefer that people learned from my hindsight so that it can become part of their foresight and avoid some significant pain.
That is a great quote.
I love that. Yeah. Our podcasts become pointless once they start to serve our agendas, as opposed to, I think, our stories serving other people's, you know. And you have wisdom. Your story has a lot of wisdom. I wish I'd heard it, you know, sooner. I think I could have learned a lot from it. So I think I speak for Sarah when we say thank you for allowing us to use our platform to tell your story and your wisdom.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here and to connect with you in this way.
No, it's really important, because, you know, you didn't have to be public. Obviously, that's been a part of your healing, you know, journey to use your voice in that way. Because unfortunately, and I understand your journey with the word cult. I think you'll appreciate the first episode of this season with Amanda Montel from Cultish. And we really look at that word cult.
Or language, really.
Yeah, language in general. But the word cult, like, I can see how awful it was when you first got out. It really separates people outside of the world to go like, well, that would never happen to me. And cult is this other extreme thing. And I think all of us are on this journey of like exploring what we went through, what is, not, you don't even have to even say cultish, bad about it. What's bad about it that creates this concept of cult, and how can people learn from that? And if you don't use the word cult, then it doesn't draw the attention. But if you do use the word cult, it separates people. So it's a little bit
culty, Sarah. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. So that, you know, we're just, it was a little, what happened there was, regardless, it was definitely a little bit very culty, you know, the head shaving. Yeah.
I mean, there's just no getting away from it. And I think that what I've come to realize is that when you're having a conversation about the subtle degrees in which your experience is not a cult, you're so far down that continuum.
It's just
semantics.
Good point.
And I don't know if we have time for this, but I think it relates. When in 2020, when the podcast came out on Wondery, that it was July, and a few weeks after, so it was dosing out to the public in, you know, for the next 8 weeks. And that was around the time that The Vow was released on television. And one of my very dear friends who was also in the Sweat Lodge sent me a text to say, hey, I just finished watching The Vow. You probably want to watch this. And at the time, I was so up to my eyeballs in being made into, I didn't know I was going to be arguably a main character or the main character in Guru. And I was dealing with all of that emotion. And I was like, oh, I just can't. And then over the course of the next 6 months, the number of people who would contact me to say, have you watched The Vow yet? Have you seen The Vow? What do you think of The Vow? And it would come up in my podcast. So finally in March, I sat down, I said to my husband, like, I need to watch this. And when I watched it from start to finish, I was like, oh, these, yep.
Yep.
This,
Here we go again.
Yeah.
What was it like for you? What was it like to see it in a different context?
It's not the first, you know, in the genre that I've watched, but it's certainly the one that I related most closely to. I was in an episode of The Unexplained on the History Channel, William Shatner's show, and I'd never heard of Nexium. And I had said to the producer, don't make me look like I was in a cult. And then she took the segment with me and Kirby's mom and Yanya. That's when I first heard of Yanya. And they put us right between David Koresh and Nexium. And I was like, what is this Nexium? What is it? A new David Koresh, obviously. But so to go from that reaction to watching it and just seeing, like, when you start to understand, or at least when I started to understand what indoctrination is, of course, it's easier to see it in other people than in yourself.
Right. Because
the whole point of indoctrination, it's hidden from you. Mm-hmm. Right. So I couldn't get enough in the sense of wanting to know what happened and how this all played out. And Sarah, I mean, I did with you, I did exactly what people do with me when they watch Enlighten Us and Guru. I searched you up online and it was March and there were your websites and there was the announcement that you were starting a podcast. So it's really uncanny to be here and bringing the two stories together.
That's cool.
They go together so dramatically and so sadly.
I'm going to cry also, again.
Yeah. You know, but also like.
But also so great that we get
to meet.
It's
also positive. I mean, this is all, you know, turning
these
into positive.
That's what I mean. I'm having happy tears.
Yeah.
Well, and get to share that, you know, everybody has their own subtle, you know, differences of even, and like there's 50 people in the sweat lodge with me. There are 50 stories. Mm-hmm. And the same with you and with Nexium. And I really think the most healing thing is that if somehow these stories serve to prevent these type of violent, destructive dynamics from continuing in the background and hidden away. The world needs to know about them and they need to know they're happening all the time.
You said it.
Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Thank you. This doesn't feel appropriate to do an ass chapping right now. But
oh, it totally does.
She's game, Sarah. she's ready to go.
If that's one thing that I've learned, you got to be able to do both ends of the spectrum to be in this work,
sure.
Right?
Well, Nippy did prepare for you. We have a new segment in this. In addition to ass chapping, is in a segment called Word Salad. But we do impressions of Keith talking shit about various things, but it with a bonus. With
some
a
people
bonus.
Think I do decent impressions.
He does do a decent impression.
I've heard one or two.
Because James's word salad was more like these trite little sentences, these trite little things that were like
fortune cookie. I call it fortune cookie therapy stuff.
I think Yanya would call it thought terminating cliche.
Yes. Okay. So yep. give us yours. Word salad.
James Arthur Ray has a little bit of a cowboy in him, kind of like this guy right here. And I noticed when he was on stage, he'd be kind of like this. And his word salad would be something to the effect of, a warrior can't do it till he's done it. Then it's done. I'm going to say that again. A warrior can't do it until he's done it. And then it's done. Y'all think about that.
That was it. Followed by... Are you with me?
Are you with me? Yeah, so amen. Sit again. Are you with me? I can't hear you.
Laura, you're bearing with us so beautifully. What was the thing that chapped your ass the most? It could be, forget James, because he's had taken too much time on this podcast. It could be about this whole industry or whatever you want. What's chapping your ass?
It's chapping my ass. Two things. It's chapping my ass more and more that this hasn't become the issue of the day yet, that it hasn't become the equivalent of a hashtag Me Too. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't been looked at under a very large spotlight So that's chapping my ass. And then I have a Canadian chaps my ass. Can I give a Canadian sure. chaps my ass?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My Canadian chaps my ass is that it is so easy for the American gurus to come into Canada and do unlimited business for, I believe it's up to 5 days. So to come in, grab all the money and go back south of the border. And when I look into what it's like for me or another Canadian to go and do business in the United States, there's a great big wall. So that chaps my ass how uniquely vulnerable our market is to it. And when you watch these documentaries, there is a large representation of Canadians.
Sarah, what have I said about how the entrepreneur and the workforce is not protected here? Your voiceover, you'd be making way more American dollars. I think how they outsource, how America, and I'm American, so, and I'm believe in capitalism, and I'm American, probably to a fault, according to my wife. But when I see some of the stuff that goes on in Canada, I'm like, how are they coming up here, getting discounted talent when the talent pool is comparable to what you're going to get anywhere else? Paying them less in the voiceover industry and the acting industry, like where are the minerals up here? When is someone going to stand up and say, screw you? And like, and I think Vancouver, particularly in the industry that we're in, could stand on its own in a lot of ways, but I agree with you.
But it's ass chapping.
It is ass chapping.
I think I have a response to the ass chapping of the first one that you said. It's if the powers that be start to hold these quote unquote gurus accountable, they're somewhat hypocrites because a lot of what goes on with politicians and other things, it sounds a lot alike. You know, James Arthur Ray maybe could run for local office because the pursuit of truth and the pursuit of power are two different pursuits. And seldom are they bed partners, right? In order to get power, you have to subvert truth. In order to tell the truth, you're probably going to lose power because you're telling people what they need to hear as opposed to what they want to hear.
Anything else that you want to share with our audience that you just wish that people knew about all of this? Something you want to impart?
Yeah, I think it's something that I need to continually remind myself is that there's nothing wrong with you if you're curious and trusting. Mm-hmm.
It's not a vulnerability, is it?
No, in fact, it's the basis of some really powerful relationships. And what I hope, and I'm still idealistic in terms of thinking that some things in the world can change, you know, so I don't think that the blame and shame needs to be directed towards ourselves as, you know, participants, as seekers, as self-helpers, whatever you want to call it. And I hope that there comes a day when most people hearing stories like this have a compassionate response, because really what is happening is, you know, there's predator and there's prey. And the prey, why should we be suspecting? You know, obviously we should be now, but because we've got the hindsight.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time with us. I'm so glad that we met in person and that we're on this, I like the word path, that feels culty. Journey also feels culty. What are we doing? Quest. Oh, shit. Also culty.
In this, okay, that's all in this podcasting thing.
Yes.
They've stolen all the words. Yeah,
they've all been appropriated. Oh, man. Thank you for doing this with us. Where can people find you? You have your own podcast called
Free Your Inner Guru, and it lives on freeyourinnerguru.com. And my photography and personal writing is on lauratucker.com.
Beautiful. We'll put all those in our show notes, and we'll see you on your podcast in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Wow, that was a lot more emotional than I expected.
Yeah,
it to
that
be.
Was, I mean, I think we could talk to her for a long time.
I think we say that with every guest.
Yeah, that's probably true. None of them would cheat.
I hope everyone leaves this episode with, you know, feeling okay to still be a seeker, but also, you know, do your homework. A lot of these people are out there trying to help people and they just don't have the credentials and are reading, you know, how to do various self-help exercises / be a warrior out of various books that anyone could get at the library and making themselves gurus / rock stars. And it's got to stop.
Anything that has a retreat to Sedona, wait 24 hours before you make that decision.
Sorry, Sedona.
Yeah.
Beautiful city.
I love it.
Be careful.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Sink and down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.